Welcome to Studio 2 on a Wednesday. I'm Cherry Gregg.
On a Wednesday, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Full show today, Cherry. The Sixers. They are not just an arena proposal company. They actually play basketball, and we're going to talk about them at the end of this segment. They are in something called the play-in tournament.
That?
So we're going to explain what it is and tell you how the season is going as they embark on their postseason journey. Then, middle segment, it's tough to get a house
these days. It is.
In the city, in the suburbs. Aaron Mozell and Kenny Cooper, both of WHYY, have teamed up to explore this problem across the region, and we're going to talk with them about their findings.
Yeah, we're going to get some details about what the market really looks like. Will we see some relief? How much do you need to actually buy a house right now?
Yes.
And the number is pretty high.
And the number to call to share your home search story is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Also, third segment today, if you want to chime in on that, same email, same number. The third segment is about gun violence reporting, how we cover the scourge of gun violence in our city. New documentary examines this. We'll talk to two folks involved in the documentary and then expand out from there.
Yeah, look, busy show today.
Busy show.
And we'll jump into the news, I guess.
News headlines. Yeah. I believe you are going to start us today.
Yeah, Philadelphia police issued an arrest warrant for State Representative Kevin Boyle. Yesterday, he allegedly violated a protection of abuse order, and he's expected to be charged for violating that order. Now, Representative Boyle is seeking an eighth term in office in next week's primary election. And all of this adds yet another wrinkle to his bid for re-election. He's currently being challenged by another Democrat, Sean Daugherty. You probably heard that name, Daugherty. They're both from very political families. But this has been a continuation of an ongoing saga, unfortunately, with Representative Boyle. He's had a number of issues, including an outburst that went viral on social media a while back, and it caused him to lose access to the Capitol, also to lose his chairmanship of a committee in Harrisburg. And so this is a tough time. You know, no one's calling for Representative Boyle to resign at this point, but the Democratic Party has basically given money to his opponent.
His primary opponent.
Yeah, they really need to keep a Democrat in this seat, and Boyle represents the Northeast, which is a very mixed section of Philadelphia. So there's a real chance that in November, with the right Republican, if he is, you know, successful in the primary, that someone can swoop in and take that seat, a Republican come in and take the seat.
We want to be respectful of the personal details here. But like you said, the fact that this is a very politically important seat does lend another dimension to this entire saga, which, like you said, is a very sad saga. And his brother, the congressman, Brandon Boyle, is on the record saying that he's had mental health challenges on and off, and the family is really trying to help him. So, again, we don't want to go too deep on that.
On the allegations, but
The political ramifications are very real here.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of political ramifications, there is an basically open, U.S. Senate seat in New Jersey, and that is because the current sitting senator, Democrat Bob Menendez, is going through it right now. He is amid a federal trial for bribery, using his position in the Senate, as you probably have heard, to dole out personal favors. We got an update recently about his strategy for defending himself, and maybe it's not a surprising one, but it is a bold one, and it's basically, it seems that he is going to blame his wife for all or most of this, and basically say, I didn't understand what was going on here with the alleged bribes. And in this particular case, I guess, like I said, not super surprising if it is borne out that his wife was the person running this entire scheme. It does totally change the political ramifications, because it means that the person who is the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was not abusing his power to help friends. So it's important if it's true, but it also could just be a a legal strategy. So I'll get your thoughts, Counselor Greg, on this.
Yeah, because, you know, we talked about this a few months ago about how he doesn't necessarily, there's a spousal immunity. He doesn't necessarily have to testify. They can't be compelled to testify against his wife.
Yeah.
And so now he's going to open the door. That's according to this these documents. By the way, this part of the filings that were made earlier this year had been sealed.
Yep.
And some reporters, journalists
sued
to open this up. And that's how we're all able to talk about this now. Another little wrinkle is they were going to have their trial together. And the senator had sued, I mean, not sued, but had filed a motion to separate so he could do this. Or we didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
But and the court had denied his motion to sever. But apparently Nadine Menendez, his wife, has some medical issues. And so they're going to have two separate trials with the senator's trial going first. Hers is going to be postponed. And so all of it will likely come out in the trial. And we'll get to hear exactly what the defense is and you know, whether or not she kept him in the dark or what he says is exculpatory evidence. Yeah. And it's going he claims he's going to be exonerated in these papers.
Procedure and chronology matters so much often in criminal trials. And that seems to be the case here. So speaking of legal stuff.
I know.
Story number three.
The case is a case of Jelly Roll versus Jelly Roll. A Pennsylvania wedding band named Jelly Roll, one word, is suing country music singer and rapper Jelly Roll, two words. They are claiming trademark infringement. I love these type of stories, Avi. That's my
legal
eagle.
Taco Tuesday thing all over
again. Yes, all over again. Well, Jelly Roll, one word, the band, they are based in Chatsford, Pennsylvania, and they've been performing for 40 years, doing weddings and big events all across our region. They've even performed at the White House, Avi. And Jelly Roll, two words, he's 39 years old, and he just blew up. He won New Artist of the Year at the Country Music Association Awards last year. I want to, like, let's play some of their music so you
this
can
is back
hear
to back
this.
Here.
Yeah, back to back.
Okay.
Take a listen. I'm not ashamed to come and plead to you, baby.
Okay, so you first heard Pennsylvania Jelly Roll,
which
followed
is good,
by
yeah.
Tennessee Jelly Roll.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
matter that they sound so different?
It doesn't matter because the bottom line with trademarks, it's whether or not they're confused in the marketplace. And the band is claiming that every time you search Jelly Roll,
you get
Jelly
other,
Roll,
get
the country music singer comes up. You have to scroll down a little bit on the Google search to find their website.
That's tough.
And they say, look, they have a registered trademark. They've been performing and using this trademark for 40 years before Jelly Roll, the country singer, was even born, mind you. Mm. And they're telling Jelly Roll, guess what, boo? You got to find a new name because we were here. The band was here first.
Guess what, boo? I'm so glad that I named my wedding band Honey Bun because I didn't get caught up in all this.
By the way, Jelly Rolls are delicious. I actually do like Jelly Rolls. So anyway.
Well, the band from Pennsylvania can't lose because they got into the news.
No, and they have an actual registration.
Well, but they got into the news with this.
Yeah.
I feel like at the end of the day, it's worth whatever they're paying the lawyer to draw up the lawsuit because we're talking about, by the way, for your wedding needs in the Delaware Valley, please contact Jelly Roll.
And by the way, they're on their website. They have a whole thing, the real Jelly Roll.
Real?
Like, I don't leave. So they're leaning all the way in.
Right.
They're leaning
so presumably you couldn't do this just because if it was their real name, if you, Cherry Gregg, decided to go by the name Cherry Gregg as a singer, and there was already a singer named Cherry Gregg, you couldn't be sued for just
using my name. No.
Yeah, okay. So it's just the fact that it's an invented name.
Yeah, it's an invented name. And it's not, I mean, unless if his name was legally Jelly.
Well, I do think it was his childhood nickname. I do think that's legit.
Yeah, but I mean, he just started using it in commerce. Mm. And use in commerce is an element of this claim.
I am so happy to have your expertise here. This is just really
delightful.
This
is like my jam. This is my jam. So anyway.
So you know what?
We'll see what happens,
feel a tangent coming on earlier, but I'm going to save it.
Oh.
Because of time. And I think let's just switch right over now to a team that's on a roll, the Sixers. Okay.
Yes. After a long and strange regular season, the Sixers begin their postseason journey tonight. Notice I said postseason, not playoffs. That's because the Sixers are in something called the play-in tournament for the first time since this concept was established 3 years ago.
So what is the play-in tournament, and how are the Sixers doing this year? Mike Sielski knows. He's a sports columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer and joins us again on Studio 2. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Avi. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for having me.
All right, so explain this play-in tournament. The Sixers are in it tonight. This is their first and hopefully their last game in the play-in tournament. How does it work?
So here's how it works. The NBA implemented this in 2001 basically to try to reduce interest in the postseason and make up some money coming out of the pandemic. So the Sixers finished the Eastern Conference with the seventh best record. They will play the Miami Heat tonight, who had the eighth best record. The winner of that game will automatically go into the postseason tournament, be one of the top eight seeds. The loser will play the winner of another play-in game tonight between the Atlanta Hawks and the Chicago Bulls. And so two of these four teams, the Sixers, the Heat, the Hawks, and the Bulls, are going to advance to the playoffs, and two are not. And to boil it down for you guys, basically, if the Sixers lose tonight, and again on Friday, their season is over. If they win tonight or win on Friday, then they're in the playoffs.
Okay, let's go back to the season because a lot of folks haven't necessarily watched all the games. Get us caught up. We've described this as a long and strange season. What has stood out to you?
Well, it's almost like two different seasons, Sherry. There's the season that the Sixers have had when Joel Embiid has been available and able to play, and there's the season when he has been out of the lineup with injury, as he often is. So when Joel Embiid has been in the lineup, the Sixers have been one of the best teams in the NBA. And when he and Tyrese Maxey, the Sixers star guard, have been in the lineup together, you could make an argument they're the best team in the NBA. They're something like 31-8 or 30-8 when the two of them play together. The problem is that Embiid tore his meniscus and his left knee back in January, I believe, and has been out of the lineup on and off before coming back within the last couple of weeks. And without Embiid, the Sixers are not much of a contender for anything. So the fact that Embiid is back and Maxey is there, and there's a relatively okay supporting cast, has people optimistic that they could actually make a deep run in this postseason.
But they got to win tonight. So you're saying Embiid is back and Maxey is healthy. Do they have a good shot tonight against this Miami Heat team? Because Miami, Mike, it seems they're always there when the chips fall at the end of the postseason. They seem like a really strong team.
Well, they're a very strong postseason team, Avi, mostly because they have a guy who might be familiar to some of our listeners, Jimmy Butler, who kind of plays possum for the regular season, and then once the playoffs begin, becomes an entirely different player who's so much better than he was during the regular season. And last year, the Heat were the eighth seed and were actually in the play-in, and then made it all the way to the NBA Finals before losing to the Denver Nuggets. So that's why people are worried about this game tonight. The Sixers, with Embiid and Maxey, are a better team than the Miami Heat. The problem is the Heat have this long history of kind of overachieving and being really tough at this time of year, and they have Jimmy Butler, who is a completely different guy than he is in February, and so people are worried.
They rise to the moment, the Miami Heat.
Yeah, so new coach this year. How will that impact the approach to the playoffs or this play-in?
Well, yes, you're right, Sherry. Nick Nurse has been the Sixers coach all season. He replaced Doc Rivers. Nurse is a much, much stronger in-game coach when it comes to strategy and designing a game plan for a particular opponent. So in a situation like this, it should work to the Sixers' advantage. Nick Nurse is really respected around the NBA for his basketball acumen. Doc Rivers, a former NBA guard, was much more like, hey, I'm just going to let the players kind of dictate what we're going to do. Nurse is much more hands-on from a strategy standpoint. He likes to try to game plan for a specific opponent. And so I think that's an advantage the Sixers have in this postseason compared to what they had in recent years.
Nick Nurse, take us to the promised land. Thank you so much for breaking it all down. That's Mike Sielski from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks again, Mike.
You got it, guys. Thank you.
And coming up, we are talking about the housing market and why it almost seems impossible to become a homeowner these days. Looking forward to that discussion. Hopefully we'll have some light at the end of the rainbow. Right? We'll be
yes.
right back.
The end of the rainbow. Interesting.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2, Our House. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. If you are hunting for a house this spring, you will need a lot of luck. Springtime is typically a boom time for home buying, but this season, times are really tough. With interest rates at a 20-year high, homeowners are holding onto their houses, and home buyers are finding daunting prices.
To get a better sense of the real estate market in the Philly region and where things are headed, we are joined by two WHYY reporters, and we love collaboration here at Studio 2. These two have been talking with home buyers, real estate agents, and economists. Aaron Mozell covers housing and community development for WHYY's Plan Philly. Aaron, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Kenny Cooper covers suburban Philadelphia for WHYY. Kenny, welcome back to the program.
Hey, guys.
And of course, for our listening friends, if you have a question about the housing market, the phone lines are open. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Aaron, we're going to jump in. We've heard that the housing market is tight over the past year or two, but how bad is it? Can you give us an overview of the current situation?
Yeah, so as you mentioned in your lead-in, a lot of the dynamics that are in play this year were in play last year. It's just been kind of unrelenting. You have high mortgage rates that, as you said, were a 20-year high, so we're talking about them still hovering around 7%. Which has a lot of folks questioning whether or not they can afford to get into the housing market because they can't afford a mortgage at that rate. It also has a lot of existing homeowners saying, maybe I should stay put because I refinanced during the pandemic or I bought during the pandemic when mortgage rates were half as high, you know, in the 2-4% range, and they just don't want a higher mortgage as well. So it's created this really bad situation where there's nothing to buy because people aren't selling their homes. And at the same time, home prices are overvalued. They continue to be overvalued. And so that's sort of been a deadly combination for anyone, particularly first-time home buyers.
It's all gummed up.
And by some respects, by some reports, inventory is even lower than it was last year. So it's even tighter.
Wow.
But it's certainly no better than it was last year. So it's a real struggle.
Kenny, you talked to some folks and got their stories about how that's affecting their personal home searches. What stood out to you in that reporting?
Yeah, so I met with a couple, Spencer Home and Samantha Home, last year, actually, at a pop-up newsroom event last fall in media. And the conversation drifted towards the housing market. You know, they're from the Radnor area. You know, they went to college, graduated. They were renting in media. And they were telling me about this impossible situation, you know, basically trying to buy a home, a starter home. And as we've been doing this reporting for this story, I reached back out to them. We're just like, you know, are you guys interested? They were like, sure. So I learned a little bit more about their story. And they told me about how hard they had saved and how they expected, you know, the down payments to be a lot lower and how they kind of have this whole life plan, you know, already written out in their heads, you know, work, save money, you know, have kids, we'll buy a home, then have
kids.
Have
kids, yeah.
Right? And, you know, the housing market has kind of flipped all that on its head. You know, it's an impossible situation for them because as they're looking in the greater Philadelphia region, collar counties, they're finding that, you know, these starter home prices that they imagined and, you know, that they foresaw are not what's actually playing out. You know, they're seeing prices $100,000, $200,000 higher than what they were anticipating.
And a higher interest rate to go along with it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I wanted to follow up because $300,000 to $400,000, guys, that seems like it would be pretty good money a few years ago, but $300,000 to $400,000 at your budget is not enough.
Yeah.
I mean, Kenny, your family here, It wasn't enough.
Yeah, it wasn't enough, you know, and that's kind of made them kind of rethink how they want to even script out, you know, their lives, right? You know, to say, you know, go from saying, you know, we're going to buy this home first, then have kids, to now saying, hey, we may have to start a family in a two-bedroom apartment is a drastic change in someone's life plans.
Right, because there's not only the mortgage and the price of the house, then you have to come up with a down payment to go with that price. And for that step, that's sort of a non-starter for a lot of folks as well.
Yeah, and also just to add on to that, you know, these are people from the area. You know, Radnor, they're from that area. And to go and live your life, go to college, and then not be able to afford a home where you grew up is actually, you know, it's kind of sad, you know, to go through and expect to buy a home where your parents, where your, you know, uncles, grandparents may have had a home. It's just, it's hard to swallow.
All right. So surely there are some solutions here, right, Aaron? I mean, we're talking about lack of inventory. How about building some houses? I mean, is that a possibility?
It is. Historically in the country, we're way behind in housing production. Mm-hmm. And because things are more expensive everywhere, generally speaking, new housing production is down, particularly in Philadelphia. It's not to say that nobody's building anything, but if you look at sort of how many permits were issued, you know, a couple of years ago versus this year, like there's been a pretty serious decline. So really, I think a lot of folks are banking on things improving with the mortgage rates, because if you get down to maybe 6% or maybe 5%, then you have some existing homeowners that are saying, all right, I can make this math work. Maybe I may still take it on the chin a little bit, but it won't be as big of a hit. And so then there'll be more houses on the market. And that's starting to happen slowly, but not in the way that people need.
And Kenny, is there anything municipalities can do? I mean, or our governments, can they do things to incentivize building, to incentivize, you know, affordable housing availability? What can they do?
Yeah, you know, a lot of this is kind of in their court, specifically in the suburbs. You know, the way that zoning is set up, the way that you have these requirements, you know, the key to the future is actually lies in the fact of having some of these suburban municipalities, you're talking your townships and your boroughs, rewrite zoning laws to allow for more construction and more housing. But the issue is that some of these, you know, developmental goals run into two problems. One is affordability. You know, some developers just don't necessarily have affordable housing in mind. But two, you run into neighbors, you know, neighbors that may think that, you know, any new development clashes with the old, you know, spirit of whatever neighborhood they may live in. And that's what you see constantly play out, is that, you know, neighbors may have overdevelopment concerns for one way or another, you know, legitimate or not, that, you know, serve as additional obstacles to the construction of new housing stock.
So what I hear you saying is, even if local officials wanted to act, there's a big political wind blowing against them over and over and over again. It's not because townships are so small. You're talking about the same phenomenon playing out in township after township after township. Do I have you correct?
Yeah, and you know, it differs from township to township. Like, some townships are more welcoming to the idea of having, you know, let's be a little bit more creative, let's add this. Mm-hmm. But you got to consider that a lot of the suburbs of Philadelphia are old, they're historic. People like the way their houses look, they like the way their neighborhoods look. So for them, it's really difficult for them to imagine building a new, you know, style or denser housing when it conflicts maybe with the aesthetics of where they already live. Mm. And, you know, that essentially is how it is. It's, you know, it's attitudes, you know, towards this possibility of constructing new housing that's kind of serving as an additional obstacle.
Are attitudes different in Philly?
In terms of
this sentiment against development, do you think there's more possibility to build in Philly? We have about a minute left.
I think there's a lot of complaints about building in Philly. I think it's very tough, especially when we're talking about affordability as an issue. It's become harder and harder for developers to do projects that work if they want to offer some affordability component. And there's a lot of complaints about that in terms of, you know, who can afford to buy the homes that are actually being built right now.
So, and a quick follow up, because you told the story of a guy who had thought between $175,000 and $250,000, and that's not enough in Philly either.
Right. Yeah. So he's thinking about, you know, do I want to move down south where generally housing prices are cheaper? Sort of similar to the folks that Kenny interviewed who were sort of playing around with the idea of moving to New Jersey. Just, you know, I think everyone is widening their scope of where they may want to live because it's just not what they thought it was going to be.
And therein lies the risk, stagnation and decline as people just leave the area altogether. Fascinating stuff. We were talking with Aaron Moselle, who covers housing and community development for WHYY's Plan Philly, and Kenny Cooper, who covers the suburbs for WHYY. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up next on Studio 2, how news headlines about gun violence re-traumatize survivors and mislead the public on crime. We're going to talk about it. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We heard some positive news recently. Philadelphia has seen a sharp decrease in the number of homicides and gun violence incidents over the past 2 years. In fact, Philadelphia is on track for the lowest number of homicides since 2018.
But it really doesn't feel like things are getting better. And part of the issue is news coverage. There is a lot of crime coverage, and studies have shown that news reporting on crime and gun violence can influence our perception of whether the city is safe. It can be scary and downright traumatizing at times for the average viewer. Well, imagine how news coverage affects the people and families who are directly impacted by gun violence.
The Second Trauma is a documentary that shows the effects of episodic news reporting on survivors and co-victims of gun violence. It also offers solutions on how to shift the narrative to refocus on public safety. The film is produced through a partnership between the Logan Center for Urban Investigative Reporting at Temple and the Philadelphia Center for Gun Violence Reporting. Jim McMillan is director of PCGVR, and here alongside Aronde McLean, who is featured in the film, Aronde is also a credible messenger newsroom liaison with PCGVR. Welcome to you both.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Yes. And so we're going to jump right in. Jim, we see a profile of a survivor, you, Aronde, and two co-victims of gun violence. The stories are quite compelling. But before we dig into that, what was the intention and purpose of this film?
You know, that's nobody's ever asked me that because I'm not the director, so I kind of followed along. I can talk more about how it happened because the director, Yvonne Letty, the director who's also the director of the Logan Center for Urban Investigative Reporting at Temple, and I were old friends. We used to work at the Daily News 30 years ago, and when she got this job, we reconnected. And the day we happened to have a cup of coffee was the same day that Aronde had a screening of the video that he produced with the Credible Messenger Project, right?
Yes.
And so Yvonne went to the screening with me. I invited her to the screening with me. She saw Aronde. She saw the community he could convene. And she saw the energy around community storytelling around gun violence and prevention. And that's when she, I think, determined that she really just had to make this video. So I like to think I played a support role around the film and the event, but I wasn't a producer in the film, actually. Right.
So, Jim, you were in the news business for many, many, many years. Presumably, you have been in many, many, many crime scenes. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about how you covered crime and where you think, you fell short.
Thanks. Yeah, this is tough, but this is what I'm doing now, I guess. So I was a photojournalist mostly for almost 30 years, and 17 of those at the Philadelphia Daily News, and most of those on the breaking news beat. We used to call it the spot news beat. And in Philadelphia, when you cover breaking news, that means covering a lot of gun violence. I probably pulled up on 2,000 shooting scenes over my 17 years, and that's only about 10% of the shootings that took place during that period. And I did this with the best of intentions. The theory of change in journalism in the 20th century, when I got here in the 90s, was that we would illuminate social problems and news organizations would hold leaders accountable and problems would get fixed.
Sunlight as disinfectant, basically.
Right. And like a lot of theories with good intentions, it didn't really work out that way. And what I've learned over my career since then through teaching and fellowships and other opportunities I've had later in my career was that maybe that reporting did more harm than good. Oh. So it's a lot to face. And so my response is to do the best I can to address that before I'm done.
And Jim, I want to ask you one more question before we bring Aronde in. But Dr. Jessica Beard, a trauma surgeon at Temple University who works with your organization, did some research on the impact of news reports on firearm injured people. And a lot of that research is sort of wrapped into this film. What were her findings?
Yeah, thanks. So we published our first. So we've got Dr. Beard leads an interdisciplinary research collaborative at our center, and we published our first study last year. It's titled "Like I'm a Nobody: Firearm Injured People's Perspectives on News Media Reporting About Firearm Violence." And in this case, they spoke. Our research team interviewed a couple of dozen recent survivors of gun violence at Temple University Hospital, and asked them for their feelings on news reporting covering individual incidents of gun violence, including their own. And the response was damning. They said that the news reporting left them feeling scared, hopeless, and dehumanized, that it led them to re-experience trauma, that it did harm to their reputation, they believed that it put them in more danger, that it might lead them to acquire and carry a gun. And there's endless research that shows where there are more guns, there'll be more gun violence. A couple of other notes, they reported no positive benefits to this kind of reporting. And maybe most amazingly, not one of the study participants had been contacted by a journalist. Or in other words, their stories were told about them, but without them.
Through police reports, essentially, not through contacting them directly.
Almost entirely through police reports, and absolutely the participants in the study were not contacted now.
I want to bring in a clip now of this is a woman named Angie Wade, and her son, Joseph Daniels III, was killed in 2019. This is her talking about seeing the coverage of her son's fatal shooting from the documentary.
Just the fact that they was airing all this stuff on the news with his truck and the bullets in the street and the tape in the ground was really traumatizing for us. And the thing is, they was doing all this stuff without notifying me. I didn't find out where my son was until 3 days. I didn't know where he was. No reporter ever came to my house to interview me, to ask questions, or to talk about anything concerning my son.
Aronde McLean, you conducted this interview, right?
Yes.
What did you learn from hearing her story?
I learned that the news reporter and reporters just not doing their job correctly.
Hmm. Expand on that.
So when they go into the victims and the co-victims' houses, they just don't know anything, and they want all the wrong stuff. They'll never ask, are you okay? How are you doing? They just want to know where your family was just killed, and do you know anything about it? They're not comforting or nothing like that.
They ask for the wrong stuff. That's so interesting.
Yeah, and Aronde, I want to zoom out because you're acting as a journalist in this film, but this is very personal to you in many ways because you're also featured in the film.
Yes.
You are actually a survivor of gun violence. Briefly tell your story.
Yes, at the age of 10, I got shot in the back of the head. In 2000, I'm 34 now. I had to learn how to walk, talk all over again. The bullet entered the back of my head and exploded. So I have 36 fragments in my head as we speak right now.
Wow. And talk about how your experience with the news coverage about your incident.
Oh, yeah. I used to watch the news all the time. I mean, because when I was 10, I didn't know I got shot in the head. I was actually watching the news when I was 12. I was watching the news and my face popped up. It used to call crime fighters. And it popped up and said, hey, Aronde McLean, my picture popped up. Aronde McLean, if you know anything about this boy got shot in the back of the head, reward is $20,000. After 2-3 minutes later, I had my first seizure. And it caused a lot of frictions with my family, doctors. I couldn't trust nobody because how would somebody lie to me that I got shot in the head. No reporters contacted my family. Hey, this is about to air. Maybe he shouldn't watch this or anything like that.
Yeah, so you had been told a totally different story about what had happened to you. It was that you were told that you had been in a car crash?
Yeah, they said I was hit by a car.
Hit by a car.
Yes.
And it turned out and that's how you learned you had been shot. So you said something interesting earlier, Aronde, about asking the wrong types of questions. What do you think are the right types of questions?
That's a good question. I always, being a journalist now for the community, I ask the people, are you okay? Do you want to talk about this? Are you fine? Do you need any resources? Before I jump in and say, oh, your son got shot, how you feel about this? Because they're still human. Like, we're human. We need to all get along and work together. Like, imagine yourself that your son or your daughter got shot. How would you want somebody to come off to you?
Yeah, because everybody's so focused on the story. I want to play another clip from Angie Wade, and she sort of talks about the impact of negative coverage and offers a solution.
I know it's necessary to report on negative things, but it's equally important to report on positive things. That can change the mindset of people. If you're constantly being fed and you seeing all this negative stuff, you know, people lose hope. Like, it's no hope here. It's always negative, negative, negative. But when you change it up and show positive things, it gives people hope. It makes you want to go out here and say, maybe this is something that I want to be a part of.
And so, you know, Jem, I want to bring you back into the conversation, because in the documentary or the film, Dr. Beard says, quote, gun violence in our city and what it looks like to survive a firearm injury is much more than the crime scene. It's much more than the bullet casings. It's much more than the crime tape. I want to offer solutions to this. What have you found? What have you heard from folks saying, like, we would like to see more of fill in the blank?
Hey, thank you for that. And, you know, I'd like to add a beat first related to that question. I also want to add that we see the good reporting. We track everything at our center. We see the community informed reporting, trauma informed reporting,
solutions
reporting, of course, evidence based reporting, the special projects. But you know, it's and I also like to say we know it's hard work. Several people on our team have done it, but. No, I forgot your question.
No, just sort of, what are some of the other solutions? I mean, we've been doing this.
Yes.
And that were offered by the co-victims and survivors.
No, thanks. Yes, and I guess that's what I was saying. So I like to say that it's not just my point of view, by the way. Now we have, you know, we've had events for 5 years, and our work is informed by workshops with community members and, you know, people who've been dramatically affected, as well as with journalists and researchers. And that's just what they're saying. They want, well, everything Aronde said, like, mostly, I think, well, you know, our mission is that we say that we're advancing more empathetic, ethical, and impactful reporting. So Aronde addressed the empathetic, like, the, first of all, to just, you know, they want empathy from the journalists, as Aronde said. Ethical journalism, you know, those standards are pretty clear to journalists, but impactful reporting should be based on, you know, evidence-based responses, strategies to prevent violence that have been shown to be effective, rather than those just led by those who might control the narrative and not actually have.
Give me an example of that.
Well, you know, for example, we feel like there's much too much concentration on police perspectives when they don't always play a very important role in prevention. And focusing only on the police perspective, you know, can diminish the public health response, create false efficacy of police, and you know, ignore, you know, real causes or solutions, and can end up blaming victims and not systems. A public health framing instead of a law enforcement or criminal justice framing would begin by saying that gun violence is preventable, not inevitable, and that you look upstream to, you know, structural causes and evidence-based solutions, things like community-based responses, violence interrupters, fixing infrastructure, hospital-based intervention programs, cleaning and gridding lots, and a million other things.
And I want to zoom out, because one of the things we talked about is this feeling, this perception doesn't always match what the actual statistics say. We've talked about the fact that crime, that homicides are down, shootings are down significantly, but it doesn't feel like it. When we talk about people in the general public, this has an impact on us watching this coverage as well.
Yes, thank you. And this is fascinating to me. And I'm seeing this discrepancy now more than ever. For example, you know, this year, there have been less than 300 shootings so far this year versus 500 at this time last year. We're down 44% in terms of shooting victims. We're back to pre-pandemic rates after a dramatic spike. And yet I'm hearing even public officials say things like, we're being led to believe that the numbers are down, but it feels different. I want to respect that because people feel different in different places. Maybe they feel different at crime scenes or at funerals. But this is official city data that we're citing that shows that it's down. So for most people, when I can only try to imagine the reason for the discrepancy between the facts and the perception. And it might be, it might have something to do with what's being communicated to the news audiences.
So I think where some people might push back is they would say, well, isn't it better to inform the community that A, something violent happened in their neighborhood, and B, sort of better than nothing, right? Like, it takes a lot of time and resources to do the type of reporting that you guys are
sure.
Sort of encouraging folks to do. And if the trade-off was, well, we just really don't mention most shootings and murders, but the stories that we do get are sort of more, are deeper, is that a trade-off worth making?
No.
So
you say no, Aranda.
No, because say if for just my opinion, I'm fine with reporting on murders and all that. It's just the way you do it. So for example, let's say a 10-year-old boy got shot, but it's after the story, it's no solutions or it's no resources for the community. Mm. So now we're stuck like, oh man, this my next door neighbor just got shot. So what is the resource for me?
So does that mean like put something in the story like just like a link to a resource or something
yes.
like that?
If somebody commits suicide, it's a link and it's a commercial for after that.
Right.
When it comes to
call the hotline or yes. yeah.
And you feel like with gun violence reporting, with crime reporting, there should be resources for individuals
absolutely.
To make them feel safe. Also follow up. I noticed that was something that I've heard both of you say, because a lot of times, even for you, Aranda, a survivor, following up with that individual and letting people know what happened to them.
Yes. So, like, it's never a follow-up story when a survivor. Or it might be a follow-up maybe 10, 15 years from now. If another 10-year-old boy got shot, they'd call me and say, hey, how you feel about this? And then my story would air. Like, I'm not... We're not the same. It shouldn't be like that.
Interesting. Well, I appreciate you both for coming in today and talking about this documentary. It's called The Second Trauma. It'll be shown tonight, 7 to 9, at the Temple Performing Arts Center. Thank you to Aranda McLean and Jim McMillan, both involved in this project. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right. That is our show for today. Big thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez is our engineer for today. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk with you tomorrow.